Hello and welcome to part two of my interview with Clark Johnson. I'm John DeLynn. This is Mormon Stories Podcast. We've talked a lot about Clark's life. We've talked about his experience as a young gay Mormon, his experiences coming to terms with his decision to leave the church and how his family reacted. And it's seriously one of the most brilliant, I don't know, hour and a half or so of Mormon stories that I've sat through. So if you haven't checked out that part, check it out. But now we're going to dive deep into the Book of Mormon musical. And I'm super excited. I've got tons of notes that I wrote on my car drive down from Logan this morning. People are like shaking their fist at me, and I'm like, I'm not texting. I'm writing. That's not bad, is it? So, Clark, so just really quickly, you weren't in musical theater in high school.
No, yeah, I loved musicals, and my family, like many Mormon families, grew up watching, you know, a lot of Golden Era musicals, and I was certainly familiar with, you know, almost anything I could get my hands on in terms of musical recordings. I was very into the genre, and but I wasn't an actor. I didn't think I would be any good at acting. But of course, you know, I played two instruments and was into music, and my first semester at BYU, I happened to take a modern dance class because I thought that would be fun. And, you know, my parents saw my schedule and were like, what is this, among the other general elective, what is this modern dance? Oh, no, it's a PE credit is what it really is. It's a PE credit. And so, through sort of the next semester, I fell in love with dance and with dancing. And the next semester, I was in seven dance classes. Including folk dance, tap, jazz, ballet, you know, the whole gamut. So, after I got back from my mission, I auditioned for the musical theater program, and, kind of got in by the skin of my teeth because I didn't have any experience. But of course, I'd sung in church choirs and whatnot. And so my first play that I was in was actually a couple months after my mission. So I was 21 and I was sort of getting my feet wet with theater and falling in love with the stage. And, you know, I never considered that it could be a viable career. I didn't really know about Broadway or what Broadway was. Even though I'd listened to all these cast recordings, to me, in my mind, Broadway was this magical kingdom like Kolob that you don't know where it really is. Where is Broadway? These albums must just float down from the sky somewhere, you know, so when I got to school, I had a couple students that were in the musical theater program at BYU that, got cast in Les Mis on Broadway, and they would go to New York. And I was like, oh, Broadway's a place. It's a place. You can go there. And as I sort of went along in the musical theater program, and I did some summer jobs here and there, and I worked on a cruise ship and took a semester off school to go do that, And I still didn't really think that, you know, I was going to be able to make it in, you know, I never thought I was good enough to do anything with it, but I was enjoying it and I thought it was fun. And so I did a couple more plays at BYU, and I graduated with a musical theater degree, but I also was pre-med at BYU because, you know, I never thought that the theater thing would work out at all. And so I was like, well, I want to go to medical school, and that's what I should do. But by the time my graduation came around, I was like, well, maybe I'll give this a try. A bunch of my other fellow graduates were moving to New York and trying to get agents and make this whole theater thing happen. And so I was like, well, I'll move to New York and I'll give it 2 years, and then I'll, you know, take the MCAT and go to medical school. And within 2 years, I was in my first Broadway show, and it sort of happened, and I, you know, things were kind of, you know, so my two-year plan extended to 12 years, really, because I kept getting these great opportunities to perform, and so, you know, I was always a late bloomer, but in life, but I also was a late bloomer in my exposure to theater, and it was never something I thought I could do, and it just sort of happened. You know, I was very fortunate, and the right kinds of experiences came along, and to be in a Broadway chorus, if you're a certain height and you have a certain build and you look a certain way, you can get more jobs. You're sort of like this cookie cutter chorus look, and I'm exactly that height, and
which is,
you know,
what height?
Well, you know, around 5'10". You know, if you're 5'6", it's harder because you don't fit into a lineup of other chorus dancers. Or if you're 6'4", it's a little harder for you. You know, you can probably play like one role in Hello Dolly, Ambrose. You know, you're too tall. So, so if you're like, 5'9" to 6'1", you're in this little sweet spot. And, you know, so it just I didn't have any dance training until college, but I had taken all these gymnastics classes as a child, and so I was able to do these like tumbling passes, which, thanks to the pioneering efforts of Susan Stroman, who directed and choreographed The Producers and Crazy for You and, you know, numerous other things, she really got Broadway choreographers obsessed with tumbling passes. And so my first few years in theater, I wasn't as good of a dancer as a lot of the dancers because I had such limited experience. I mean, all my dance classes were from BYU and from, you know, 3 or 4 years of dance experience by the time I moved to New York. But I could do these really, really impressive tumbling passes. And so a lot of times I would get through the callback. And then I was, I had a lot more experience singing because of, you know, singing in church choirs and, you know, playing instruments and things like that. And so my first couple jobs I sort of lucked into by, various circumstances that just happened to be kind of in my favor. So,
you have this impression of someone who wants to break into Broadway of like sleeping on flea infested mattresses and like having to like sleep on the casting couch with, you know, and like starving, and that it's just this grueling, awful experience before you break in. Is that true? Not true?
Well, I mean, there are aspects of it that are absolutely 100% true. And then, of course, some of it's sort of exaggerated. I will say this. I had a very notable sort of casting couch experience that was my very first introduction to Broadway. I took a trip during my last semester at BYU, I took a trip to New York to audition for plays. And it was like this, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to New York. I've got a week, you know, I've got a week off for spring break. I'm going to go to New York City and I'm just going to, you know, open Backstage, which was the sort of casting directory, and I'm going to go to some auditions. And so I found all these different chorus calls that I could go to. And one of them was a production of Babes in Arms. And I went to the audition, and I got through the callbacks, and then I got through another round of callbacks, and the choreographer came out into the hall after one of my auditions, and he is just this dirty old man who is just wearing foundation during the day, you know, because you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to, you know, blemishes, you know. And he comes out and says, oh, you know, you did such a great job in the audition. Is this your first time in New York? Yes, it is. It's my first time in New York. Oh, how interesting. And are you a student? Yes, I'm a student I go to Brigham Young University in Utah. Oh, how interesting. Are you Mormon? Well, yes, I am Mormon, actually. Oh, how interesting. Well, I would love to show you around New York City. And would you mind if I called you? And I was like, okay, sure, you know. And so that night at 2:30 in the morning, he calls the like landline of the people that I'm like crashing on their couch, and like wants to have this conversation. And then, and of course I'm like, well, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, and I really want this job because if I got this job, I could move to New York from BYU with a job that would sort of land me in, you know, a position where I could get my union card and all these things. And so I was like, I really want to get this job. And so we meet the next day. He walks me around the Upper West Side. He goes to some flea market on the Upper West Side, shows me around the city, and then he wants to hang out again. And then we walk back to where he lives, and he was like, I'd love you to come upstairs and see my apartment. And I was like, no, I don't think I want to do that. and he was like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. I don't want to do that. And like, here I'm thinking this whole casting couch thing is some urban, some theatrical myth. And I'm like, first trip to New York, it's like, well, you could get the job, if you come up to my apartment. And I'm like, I refuse to prostitute myself for a stupid 6 week job in New Jersey or wherever it was. It wasn't even a Broadway show. I mean, come on, you got to have standards, right? If you're going to sleep with someone for a job, at least let it be a good job. For heaven's sakes, So anyway, he sort of made it very clear that if I didn't do it, I wasn't going to get the job. And then I didn't. I didn't get the job. And then I saw him after I moved to New York. I saw him later, and he was sort of, he acted really sort of weird and bitter. But then, to his credit, about 6 months later, I auditioned for him again for a production of 42nd Street in Russia. And it was very clear that he, just was very upset that I didn't, go through. And I remember during my audition, he looked up and acknowledged me, but he didn't acknowledge that he really knew me. And he seemed mad. And I was like, great, now I'm not going to get this job either. But I was like, whatever, again, you got to have standards, right? So I was like, I had medical school on the back burner. I was like, look, I'm not going to have sex with someone for a freaking job. I don't care what job it is. This is ridiculous. Like, and plus I was still Mormon. I'm like, well, I'm not going to have sex with anyone anyway. So, I'm certainly not going to have sex with you, if the choreographer was cute, at least maybe then you consider it, right? So anyway, so he gave me the job. He gave me the job. And I went and did, 42nd Street in Russia. It was one of my first performing experiences after I moved to New York. I got to go to Moscow for 6 months and, tap and do this great tap show there. And so the casting couch is definitely something that what's odd is that I feel that it's much more prevalent for gay men and for choreographers than it is for women. Because sorry for all the directors out there, but most directors and choreographers, at least in Broadway, like men. They're not into women. So women kind of get by. I mean, I'm sure Hollywood is a very different beast. I have absolutely no expertise in that version of the casting couch. But, as far as the flea-bitten, bed and all the, the Murphy, the sleeping on top of seven flatmates and things like that, that certainly does exist. My first 5 weeks in New York, I borrowed $2,000 from my parents to get to New York and put a down payment on my first apartment, which was a room share with one of my BYU friends. And it was funny because I didn't have any more money to pay the next month. So I had sort of for my flight to New York and getting a cell phone, because I didn't have a cell phone when I was at BYU, all, these few things to set up my life in New York, I had no money. And so I was like, well, I need to make money for next month's rent. And so I went out and I got a waitering job, just walked into a restaurant and was like, this seems like a nice restaurant. Let me just walk in here and see, And I just threw all my Mormon missionary self at the guy. And he was like, well, we're not really hiring. And I was like, but you could be hiring. You could hire me. And I was like, I speak Spanish. I could talk to the busboys. I could be a busboy, whatever you need. And he was like, oh, okay, we'll hire you. So he hired me. And then I got my first performing job in 5 weeks, and I sort of started, I sort of started doing traveling jobs. And so I never really had the experience of 85 flatmates, and sleeping on, little cots or something like that. But there are people that I know, friends of mine, who are like, I'm an artist. I don't know where I'm going to be next month, but that's part of being an artist. That was never really something that I think I could handle. And so, those stereotypes are certainly there for a reason, but they may not be as sort of glamorized or as prevalent as one might assume.
So 3 to 5 tips within a minute for the aspiring actor, comic, Broadway performer. What do you have to say to them if they're trying to break into something?
Okay, so not every performer agrees with this, but I think the best way to succeed in show business is to have something very viable that you can do instead. Because desperation is antithetical to success in the theater. It is antithetical to a good audition, and it's antithetical to good performing. If you are desperate, no one is going to hire you. If you want to be hired, you need to seem like you could take this job or leave this job, and you're just great, and you're not stressing about whether you get this because you have five other things coming down the pipeline that could work out for you. That is the energy of a casting. You cast someone who walks in and they're like, I don't need this job, and I don't need you to like me at all. I perform for me. Of course, no actor performs for themselves. That's part of the gig, right? You're acting even in that moment. You're pretending you don't care when really you care so much that you're shaking. You want it so bad. You can taste it. So a lot of actors will say, I'm not complying with your 2-minute thing. I'm sorry. I'm very, very bad at that. But a lot of actors will say,
I said 1 minute.
Oh, you said 1 minute.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Keep going. You're doing great. I love this. This is good.
Even better. So, you know, a lot of actors will say, you know, my advice to you, don't have a backup plan. Because if you do have a backup plan, then you'll quit because it's too hard. People will say that. And I'm like, that's awful. That's an awful way to live your life. To be an artist because you have no choice. I'm like, no thank. This is like you're a slave to your art. But you know, a lot of people want to have that relationship with their art. They want to feel like they're a slave. I had no choice. I act because I can't do anything else. It calls to me, you know? I mean, I think that's impractical, and I was if as an actor, I was nothing if not practical. I was very practical about my career, and I was like, if this doesn't work out, I will be in medical school faster than you can say Bob's your uncle. You know, I really, and so I tell that to people in theater. You know, you have to be able to develop, you have to be developed enough as a person that you can have a conversation about something else besides acting, because suddenly someone will go, you know, what's going on in France, or what's happening in this, and you're like, I know the lyrics to Crazy for You. You don't know anything about anything. And that I think comes through. So I think be a person. People want you to be a person. You walk in an audition room, they want to feel like you can connect. And they don't want to feel like they're talking to some blow-up doll that's, you know, well, I'll be whatever you want me to be, you know? So I think to develop your whole life, to develop a very broad set of skills, and to be able to do something else, so you could take or leave this acting career. You could walk away from it, and don't base your self-esteem on whether you succeed in this field. That is the biggest trap. People are like, well, if this I have a lot of friends as performers who the way they felt about themselves was an absolute direct reflection of their most recent audition. If they got a callback, they were worthy, and they were great, and they were talented. And if they got cut, they were a piece of shit, and they felt horrible about themselves, and they would eat a whole cake from the Cheesecake Factory that night, you know? Like, so, I mean, I guess if that's the way you want to live your life, go ahead. I mean, I can't stop you. But I think that, you know, for you to say, even if I don't succeed as an actor, if I never make it to Broadway, if I never get a film, if I never get a commercial, if I never break through into this world of success in theater, that doesn't mean I'm not worthy as a person, but I won't say it's very hard. It's impossible to be totally impervious to basing how you feel about yourself on whether you get hired or not, because your very income depends on whether people like you and whether they want to give you a job. And so you could just have the wrong hair color and you won't get that job. And here you are tormenting yourself about that one line reading of that one little, or that one little high note that you didn't think was ringy enough. You know, it didn't sound exactly right. You're thinking it's because of that. And really it's because you were 5'9" instead of 5'8", or you had sandy blonde hair instead of strawberry blonde hair. I mean, it really is that arbitrary. And I had a couple experiences in my time in the business of sitting on the other side of the table where I was assisting a choreographer or assisting someone. And we watch people walk in and audition. And then after the person leaves the room, like they'll be like, oh, where was that headshot again? Oh, we lost it. Oh, well, we liked her though. Oh, well, we can't find the headshot. She was great. Oh, well, we can't, we don't have the headshot. We can't call her. Like the weirdest crap. And I'm like, how did I ever get cast in anything? These people don't know what the heck they want and they're so disorganized. I'm like, casting is a miracle. It's a miracle from baby Jesus, you know? Like, how does this crap happen? So, you know, all of that was a really... What's interesting about being an actor, though, is that it teaches you to be very present and it teaches you to be very resilient because you are facing so much rejection. You really have, you really learn what you're made of by facing that level of rejection because it's a numbers game. You know, for every 20 auditions you give, you'll get a callback, and then for every, you know, 10 callbacks you get, you'll get a job. I mean, it really can be that bleak. But then you get a job and you have that job for a year. And then you, you know, if it's a Broadway show, you can make $100,000 that year, which is sort of the minimum salary of a Broadway actor. And so, you know, for a performer, that's sort of life-changing money because they're living hand to fist. Hand to mouth? What do you say?
Hand
anyway,
to
hand to mouth. So, so you know, there's a lot to be gleaned from the experience of being a performer. Overall, I think that people who have something else that they love and that they're passionate about that they can go do is a good thing. And that's my biggest piece of advice to them.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So the first time you heard about the Book of Mormon musical.
Okay. So I was rehearsing for another Broadway show called The Addams Family in the building. It's on 42nd Street, and it's where all the Broadway shows rehearse. It's called 42nd Street Studios, and it's on 42nd Street. It's right across from the New Amsterdam Theater, and you know, they have four or five floors of like really, really nice studios, big mirrors, and all the Broadway shows rehearse there. And so we were rehearsing on the sixth floor, and on the fifth floor, there was this like hush-hush project going on. And there's outside of the room of the main rehearsal studio, there's like a little placard and it says whatever the name of the show is. So, you know, Crazy for You is rehearsing in here. I've said Crazy for You three times. I'm not that obsessed with Crazy for You. I just keep coming to my head. So I hear that Matt Stone and Trey Parker are doing this show and I'm in the elevator with someone, and I'm like, what is this? What is this project going on the fifth floor? And they're like, it's a musical about Joseph Smith. And I was like, what the F? I was like, I've always thought Moroni's appearance as a salamander was especially dramatic, but please, you know, what are you going to do with a musical about Joseph Smith? Like, how do you... to say that I was intrigued was, you know, I mean, and this was after I had already left the church and I had already made peace with my parents and everything was, you know, going well.
2010?
Yeah, 2010, okay. Around there, exactly. I'm taking the elevator up and the doors open to the fifth floor and all these like people who look like Mormon missionaries, like short haircuts and stuff, they all walk out on the fifth floor and it says Mormon Project on the little placard. That's the name of the project. And I'm like, what the F? I'm like, what is this? So weird. And why am I not in it? You know, this is what every, this is what every actor goes through, right? You can't enjoy a piece of theater because you're like, I should put that song in my audition book. That would be a great comedic ditty for my next audition. Or why didn't I get this role? You know, I always say that with Book of Mormon, because there are no white female actors or characters in the Book of Mormon, I always say that the Book of Mormon is the only show that a white female actress could actually enjoy because there's no role for her. So she doesn't have to be jealous of the people up on stage. That bitch, she's so fat. I would have gotten that role of her. You know,
she can't be Jumba Jovi.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, that was one of the pre... not Bon Jovi, exactly. That was one of the pre-Broadway workshops. They were doing these very hush-hush developmental workshops. No one was seeing them, and no one knew about them at all. And so this wasn't the rehearsal for the Broadway production. This was just a developmental workshop that was happening. And I was in rehearsals for this other play, The Addams Family, which I did for a year. Then I had my agent called and said, now I know you're... were raised Mormon, and they're looking for a Mormon missionary. They've lost someone from the prior developmental workshop. Oddly, the person that they were looking for a replacement for was also Mormon, so oddly there was a Mormon in these developmental workshops, and I didn't really get the full story of why he left, but it seemed like he was a little bit at odds with the material of the show. Maybe he didn't like the F word. I don't know. Because you certainly get a lot of that. So anyway, he dropped out. And it was 3 weeks until the Broadway production, the original Broadway cast, started rehearsals. And so they needed someone immediately, basically. And so I had a little bit of a moral dilemma when I got the audition, because I knew that I was at peace with the church, but I wasn't sure what the show was about. I had no idea what the show was about, and that information obviously wasn't available anywhere. And everyone who auditioned for the show, they were giving them the sides, to have them read parts of the show. They were giving them the sides, and then they were like taking them back and not letting people even take them home, because they didn't want people to post it online or talk about what it was about. And so it was like extremely insular and extremely private. And so I had no idea. I had no idea if the show was going to like bash the church and just be like, lay it all out there, or whether it was going to be sympathetic for the church, you know. And of course, I knew that the South Park writers were amazing. You know, Matt Stone and Trey Parker were amazing writers. And I knew that they would write a great show because South Park is an amazing show, and, you know, they're incredibly brilliant. And but I didn't want to do something that would damage the sort of fledgling peace that I had developed with my parents and my family. And I didn't want this to be perceived as some sort of, Mormon bash on my part, and that I had taken part in something that was going to, sort of knock down the, again, fledgling bridge that I was building with them, because that was very important to me. And so I talked to one of my brothers, my brother Clay, who loves South Park and is a huge fan of South Park, but is still very much active in the church. And he was like, I think you should just audition for it, because, you know, he's like, it'll be fine. He's like, I think this could be a really cool thing to be a part of. And, you know, maybe you won't even get it, you know. It's that thing where, you know, you don't want to go in and audition if you have no intention of taking it, and your agent will get really mad at you. If you go in and you audition and the creative team falls in love with you and wants to cast you, and then you're like, no, I won't do it. So they want you to say no at the beginning, essentially. So, you know, after I got my brother Clay's approval, I felt like I would have enough defense if it turned out badly that I could be like, well, Clay said it was okay. No, you can't get that mad at me. You know, spread out the blame a little bit. So I went in and auditioned, and at my very first audition, I told the casting director that I was a BYU graduate, that I was a returned missionary, and that, that this was, you know, I didn't know what the story was about, but if they were looking for Mormon missionaries, I didn't think that you could get much more. The genuine article appears before you. So, it was a very short casting process. I had one callback the next day, basically, in front of the director, choreographer, and I got the job, and I gave my notice to Adam's family, and I started rehearsals the next month. And, our first day of rehearsal, I was basically one of the only new people, because they had done this developmental workshop months before.
So Josh Gad was already there.
Josh Gad was there. Andrew Rannells were there. Matt and Trey were, you know, of course.
They were there?
They were at all of our rehearsals. They were in the room. You know, they were. I have to say, I worked with a lot of creative teams in my experience in musical theater. And I saw a lot of writers, directors, you know, attempt to fix, because the process of creating a show is all about fixing problems as they present themselves. For instance, on paper, this show has great flow and the way the numbers and things weave together and the transitional elements. But when you start to put something on its feet, things, you know, anyone who works in theater knows that sometimes things just don't work the way that you think they're going to, or you're not able to, you know, you pictured it in your head a certain way and on its feet it doesn't look that way. And what really generally happens with most plays is that a problem arises and the creative team, in an attempt to fix the problem, they make another problem and put it in its place. I mean, that is like literally what will happen. They'll be like, we've made drastic cuts. The second act is so much better than it was. And we've cut this number. And then, you know, everyone's like, oh, fantastic. They cut that horrible number. Oh my gosh, the second act was really, really dragging. And then they replace that draggy number with another draggy number. And you're just, you know, it's this thing of watch, you know, it's very hard to create something that really sings and that just, that the bones of the show are just really good, and almost anybody could play the parts and it would be a success, you know? And so to watch them sort of tinker and everything they did just propped it up a little bit higher and just made it a little bit better. They are truly formidable creators and writers, and they did such an amazing job. But, you know, my first day of rehearsal, they did a full run through on its feet, but they did a, you know, sing through with music stands, and they sang, and everybody did, you know, Andrew Rannells sang, I Believe, and every, you know, and I was hearing this all for the first time, and I could not believe what I was hearing. I mean, when they were talking, you know, when Andrew was singing I Believe, and they're talking about God lives on a planet called Kolob, and, you know, I believe that, you know, my, involves me getting my own planet, I was like, holy crap. It was a collision of worlds in a way I cannot describe, because I'm sitting in these Broadway rehearsal studios hearing about Mormon doctrine that most Mormons don't even talk about that often, and being like, how the heck did they know about this stuff? I'm like, who did they talk to get this level of detail? And you know, I will say my one claim to fame with the Book of Mormon show is that they were pronouncing Lamanites, Lamanites. And I was like, excuse me. But it's pronounced Lamanites. And they fixed that. So I was like, I've contributed. Good for me, you know.
Did you make any other contributions?
Well, you know, you know,
because like when they say praise Jesus,
I know. Okay,
so no Mormon has ever said praise Jesus.
Here's
except me just now.
Here's praise Christ. That's
okay,
what they say.
Sorry.
Yes. So you know, this is what I'll tell you. So I simplified just now when I said that I corrected Lamanites. What I really did was went up to one of the creative team and I said, you know, I don't want to put my oar in because, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen, it's not my place. And they weren't coming to me and saying like, you were Mormon, is there maybe anything you want to, you know, say? Did we get it right? Maybe they just didn't want to open that bag of worms. And plus, I was new, you know. They had done all these other creative things with other people, and maybe they thought that I would attempt to do a coup, you know, mutiny. I don't know. They didn't know me. And so, you know, I remember that Trey Parker once was like, tell me about your mission, you know, and so I kind of like shared some of the things with him. But there was never sort of a policy, an open door policy where they were like, can you let us know if anything is sort of out of the ordinary to your, you know? And in my mind, I was like, okay, I'm an expert on Mormonism. You could hire you know, someone to come in but you have someone in the cast who is literally an expert on Mormon missionaries, on what they do, on what they wear, on how they talk, on what they're thinking about. You know, I'm like, I lived it. So I sort of assumed that they would come. So I mentioned to someone that it's pronounced Lamanites. And the person I told was like the assistant of the somebody, you know. I didn't want to go up and like, you know, just, again, I was new and I didn't want to step on anyone's toes. And I'm very, very meddlesome and I can be a little bit bossy, and it's gotten me in trouble in my career a couple times. And so I was like, I'll be careful because I've learned to be a little careful. So anyway, I told this, this girl who was someone's assistant of someone, and she acted a little weird, like, oh, okay, well, well, thank you. Thank you for letting us know. And I was like, oh, shit, this is, like, crazy. I was like, why is she being so weird? So the next day she comes to rehearsal and she was like, oh, everyone, oh, I wanted to let you know that I called Temple Square last night. And some little old lady in the Mormon temple, you know, I was just talking to her and she told me, she actually was talking about the Book of Mormon and she said Lamanites and not Lamanites. And so we've been mispronouncing it. And I was like, oh shit. I was like, well, clearly my input is not going to be welcome in the way that I would have liked it to be. And I mean, to be frank, they did. I mean, they got 99%. The other, you know, Praise Christ obviously is like a huge glaring thing to any Mormon. You know, like you hear that and you're like, no, we don't. No Mormon ever says Praise Christ, you know. And you know, the other thing that, you know, that always just, you know, got me a little bit is it's something that maybe a lot of even LDS people don't notice. But, you know, they have those like Hill Cumorah pageant kind of things starting the first and second act. And there's that, the one in the second act, Jesus says, you know, I just got, you know, I can't even,
come on, you guys.
Yeah, come on, guys. You know, I just got crucified. But in that time, I will preach here to you in America, you know, in the 3 days. And, you know, during those 3 days, I'm like, Jesus was doing something really weird. That's not when Jesus went to America. He was starting the work for the dead in heaven. That's the joke, right? But, you know, when he went to America, of course, he was already resurrected because he said, come feel the marks in my hands and feet, you know. And so that was a little detail that they missed. But I doubt, I mean, a lot of Mormons may not have even noticed that. But, you know, I did the show 1,250 times, so so I noticed. So anyway, there were little things like that that I wish that I could have, you know, kind of, you know, just those tiny little, you know, things that I knew would offend certain Mormons. But again, you know, where I did contribute heavily was, you know, all of the missionaries were like, can you bring in your missionary photos? Can you bring in your missionary journal? We would love to see them. And we had like long conversations about what it was like to be a missionary. And they looked at all my pictures and, you know.
Were there missionary experiences you had that related to the musical?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the sort of, I was in a rural area in Mexico and the sort of, you know, the sort of level of kind of isolation and you're kind of on your own out there in, you know,
Pueblo.
Yeah, in a Pueblo, kind of doing your own thing. And you are the gospel to those people wherever you are. And whatever you say to them about the gospel is the gospel to them. You know, that's Mormonism to them. And the way that your hair looks and the way that you're dressed and what you're eating, that's Mormonism to them because you're all of that's all, you know. So, you know, Elder Cunningham's way of presenting sort of his, you know, Lord of the Rings,
Star Wars
version of his extrapolation of what the gospel is and isn't, and how he makes it relevant for the people. You know, I mean, of course, that's a hyperbolized version of what missionaries have to do in foreign countries with you know, perhaps people who their literacy is low, they can't read the Book of Mormon for the Book of Mormon or the Bible for themselves, so they're kind of taking your word for and kind of nodding their head and saying yeah absolutely. And you know, as I said, I was in Mexico on my mission, and so you know, dealing with the Virgin Mary and how you handle presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ without a heavy presence of the Virgin Mary is a very, very tricky thing, because on every Mexican Catholic's wall is La Virgen de Guadalupe, you know, every single person. And so, you know, they're listening to this discussion with Jesus, yes, God, yes, baptism, absolutely, yes, we're with you, we're with you. And then you end the discussion, they're like, excuse me, where, Mary, is she, yeah, Maria, don't say Maria, you know, is she in there somewhere? And you're like, you know, and you want to get another discussion. Oh, yes, we revere her as the mother of Christ. And, you know, she was the vessel of, you know, and so you're kind of like, you know, Mormons don't give a crap about Mary, really. I mean, really, they don't, you know, I mean, she's there, and you appreciate the, you know, the painting, the enunciation, and there's a couple, like, you know, but in any appreciable sense, she's not important to Mormons. So that's sort of a miniature version of what Elder Cunningham does, is sort of like make it palatable, relevant to the people that are in front of you in an attempt to convert them, help them out, whatever the motive may be, you know?
Excellent. So Josh Gad, for just a second.
Yes.
I was there on opening weekend. Mm-hmm. I think it was February of 2011.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep, yeah. That's exactly right.
And I couldn't tell if he was talented. Like, when he he seemed to sing a little bit off key to me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't bring the Broadway voice. And he was obviously trying to play a nerd. But I was confused by that. Like, oh, they couldn't get someone great for that part, so they got him at first. But obviously he was hilarious.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that the...
Am I the only one to have had that experience?
No, I think a lot of people who are expecting sort of a more traditional, polished Broadway experience could have felt very confused by the casting of him, because he doesn't have that typical Broadway voice, and he doesn't seem like a Broadway actor, right? I mean, but I think what Matt and Trey brilliantly did was they basically gave you, as an audience member, this sort of meta experience of being like, he just doesn't fit in. He's wrong for this whole thing, you know, which is exactly what he is in the play, you know? He's the wrong person. He's got the wrong voice. He's got the wrong hair. He's the wrong size. He has the wrong knowledge. He's not up to par. You know, all of those things that you experienced as an audience member, I think in the mind of the creators, is exactly what they want you to feel. Like, I just don't like him. He makes me uncomfortable. I wish I was watching someone else, you know? And the brilliance of Josh Gad, that I think, is that, first of all, he, in both on stage and in life, he is an indomitable comic. He is funny every minute of every interaction you have with him. He doesn't turn it on or off. Like, who he is on stage is pretty much who he is in real life. He wants to make everybody laugh, and he does, and he's hilarious. And if he's in a group of people, they are watching him. Always, period. So, and, you know, and he earns it. He's hilarious. And he's constantly, like, developing his ability to assess the comic opportunities of the moment, you know? And so, you know, I think when you're watching, I mean, I don't know if this was your experience, but I think what they hoped in, you know, and what Josh is going for, too, is because he's actually kind of a vocal master. He actually has a very, very good voice, but he has the ability to make his voice seem kind of off-putting in a way that I think was really right for the character. And what I think they hope for by the end is that you're rooting for him. That in the end, at the beginning of the play, you're like, I just don't like you, and I wish I was watching someone else. And you look at Andrew, and you're like, yes, you're everything I want to see on stage. You're handsome. You're tall. You have a great voice. You have a commanding presence. You're likable, you know? And so I think that they wanted you to go on a journey that was similar to the journey that Elder Price is having, which is coming to appreciate him and coming to appreciate what he brings to the table, even though it's not what Elder Price sort of is trained to think of as positive attributes. The other thing that's interesting is that they really did a lot of development on Elder Price's character, because there were in several of the workshops, the developmental workshops. Of course, I wasn't there, so I got this as secondhand information from the cast. But they actually went through this period where Elder Price, in his disillusionment, his faith disillusionment, which really centers around his sort of failure to get what he deserves, you know. He's been preparing for his mission his whole life. He's done everything. He's got the hair, you know. He's got the Mormon haircut. He's got the, you know, he's got the zest for the gospel. He knows his Mormonism backward and forward. And he goes there and falls flat on his face. And his failure as a missionary causes him to doubt the entire paradigm of Mormonism. Because if he isn't the winner, then the church must be wrong, because he should be the winner. he did everything he was supposed to do. So the fact that he falls flat on his face and the fact that he fails is sort of evidence to him that the universe doesn't work the way we were told, you know? And so they really struggled with trying to decide how they wanted him to react to his faith crisis. And one of the ideas they toyed with is having him assassinate the mission president. So that actually was something they played with. And they had this, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Sweeney Todd, but there's this, it's the end of the first act of Sweeney Todd, and he addresses the audience, and he's sort of accepted the fact that his bitterness and his revenge have caused him to begin murdering people to satisfy his revenge. And so at the end of the first act of Sweeney Todd, he's like, he's just killed someone else. And he's like, you, sir, people in the audience, you know, you, how about a shave? Sweeney's waiting, you know, this big moment of like, oh, you want to die next? I'll kill you, you know? And so they had a song, Elder Price's like big song in the second act was like, what do all religions have in common? They lie. It's all lies, you know, whether it's this or that or that. And then it was like this Sweeney Todd, you know, instead of like offering to murder people in the audience, it was like murdering the beliefs of everyone in the audience by being like, this is the thing that all religions have in common. They're all liars, you know, and I'm going to murder the mission president. And I think they decided that would make him not likable.
That it's interesting you bring up Sweeney Todd, because one of the things I started to feel like during the musical was that they were actually doing parodies of other songs in other musicals. So
absolutely.
For example, Mostly Me reminded me of Defying Gravity.
Absolutely.
Right?
100%.
So were there, can you name songs that were sort
I mean,
of,
you know,
it's probably the, put you on the spot.
No, it's funny because there are, you know, there's this section of Elder Price in the second act where he's basically singing Tomorrow from Annie, and there are just, you know, there are tons of references, and only someone who is a true theater queen would get all of those references. I got all of them. So anyway, I mean, that was obviously a very intentional thing, but what I think is so successful, because you have a show like The Producers, which is like all references. I mean, it's references, 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 and drawing upon, you know, sort of like things in pop culture that people understand and presenting them in clever ways. And so, you know, Matt and Trey did a lot of that. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it was this little love letter to, you know, to golden era Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, some contemporary stuff like Wicked. But what is interesting is that that wasn't the crux. That wasn't the point of the show. I mean, the show becomes such a sort of unexpected, fascinating commentary on the value of faith, and the what is valuable about faith is not whether it's true or false, but what it does for the people that believe, how it affects the community of believers. So what I love about the show, and what I think is so amazing about the show, is that you have Mormonism being presented in a way where it's stripped down to the bones of it. You know, you're hearing all the weirdest stuff about Mormonism in a 2-hour period, essentially. You know, and the audience is laughing at it, going, I can't believe that anyone believes this stuff. The smart people in the audience are going, I can't believe anyone believes this stuff. Wait a minute, I believe the virgin birth. I believe in weird stuff too. That's what the smart people in the audience who have faith are doing. They're going, wait a minute, you could take any religion, and if you did what they're doing to this, you would laugh, everyone would laugh at that too. And then at the end of it, instead of lifting it up as a laughingstock, they show that they create this hyperbolized version of the gospel as set forth by Elder Cunningham. And the people in the village all join this weird religion where, you know, Joseph Smith fucked a frog and that cured him of his AIDS and, you know, like all of this weird stuff that the show sort of, you know, and the village believes it and they join this, you know, it's this very, this hyperbole of ridiculousness, whereas religion itself is, you know, a collection of ridiculous, unbelievable stories that people revere and hold as truths, you know, Moses parting the Red Sea, all this stuff that just, you know,
the virgin birth,
all this stuff that like didn't happen from a scientific point of view is impossible, right? And so they hyperbolize this, they tell this story that's so ridiculous that you're like, how would anyone, those Africans must be really stupid to believe this. And then at the end of it, it turns out that the Africans never believed in it and that they understood all along that it was just a metaphor for how they should, you know. One of them, you know, of course, the Nabalungi character believes all of it. She believes all of it's true. And she, for her, Salt Lake City represents, you know, Saltaleka City represents this salvation. And then at the end, the whole village is like, Nabalungi, Saltaleka City isn't an actual place. It's an idea, a metaphor, you know? And so, you know, what ends up happening, though, is that this ridiculous belief system that isn't true, and that actually they all know isn't true, has brought them together, has united them. And so, you know, this is sort of my, you know, the thing that I wish that Mormons could do is say, instead of saying, the reason I do what I do, the reason I am a Mormon is because it's true. And it's not just true for me, it's true for everybody. And for the person who says, oh, well, how do you justify the fact that I'm not Mormon and I'm very happy? Well, every Mormon will say, whether out loud or in their head, will say, well, you think you're happy. But you could be so much happier. You don't even know. So, you know, that is where I feel that the faith system of Mormonism has let its constituency down, because it teaches them that the value of their faith is in its utter, unshakable, eternal, universal veracity. It's true. And if it's not true, then it all falls apart and disintegrates. It's true, and that's what makes it valuable. And what would be great is if they could say, well, we don't know if it's true, and we certainly can't say that it's a one-size-fits-all religion. It doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but we love our faith, and we believe in our faith, and our belief is powerful, and it unites us in an ability to be good, and it makes us better people, and we treat the people of our families better because we're Mormons. But if you don't want to be Mormon, that's okay. You don't have to believe what we believe. That's fine. And when you say you're happy not being a Mormon, I believe that. Why not? What do I know? I'm happy being a Mormon. You don't have to be Mormon to be happy. So what that would do, what that would allow, is that would allow people like me, a young gay man growing up in the church, to feel like, you know, this isn't working for me. I don't feel good. I don't like the way I feel about myself. I hate feeling broken. I am sick of feeling like a loser that can never dig myself out of this like loser hole. And of course I want to die. I can't succeed in this paradigm. There's no winning situation for me. And I don't know about you, but I don't like to lose. I don't want to be a loser for the rest of my life. You know, I want to feel like if I work hard at something, I can win and I can do a good job. And that doesn't mean win by beating other people. It just means I want to succeed and I should have the opportunity to have a full, happy life. And as a Mormon, that's not an option for me. And so, you know, if Mormons could say, yeah, we believe in this and it unites us, but it may not be true for everybody, that's okay. The value of our faith isn't in its truth. The value in our faith is what it does for us as a group. It unites us. It makes us good. We're better people because we're Mormon. And not, we're better people because we have the truth. And you don't have the truth, and that makes you worse than us. And we may not tell you that to your face, but we feel that way about you. You're worse off than me, you know? And I remember being a Mormon in my head. And I remember the way that I felt about people who weren't Mormon. And if they were like, I'm happy, I suffered to go, I'm like, oh, they are so delusional. They are not happy. They have no concept of what happiness is. Meanwhile, I'm getting up in airplanes wanting it to crash. You do the math. I'm so happy, I want to die. Isn't that, I mean, come on. So bizarre.
The challenge with that is that you take away the unique, distinctive, absolutist truth claims. People maybe just won't be as vibrant about their belief.
So I think that's right.
That's the secret sauce that actually makes us successful.
I think you're right. I think that's the fear, that without that compulsion of truth backing it up, people wouldn't follow it. And I think that's wrong. I do. I think that's wrong. I think that what that tells me is that the people in charge of administering the faith don't have enough faith in the faith. Because, you know, people still become Boy Scouts, and it's not because Boy Scouts is true. You know, they do it because they say, this trains young men to spend time outdoors learning how to basket weave, which was a great merit badge for me, by the way. Very good baskets.
So I'm gonna take you through some of the songs of the musical.
Okay.
And I want to, if you want to talk about a funny experience with the song, an insight from the song.
Okay.
Talk about the theme of the song.
Okay.
I'm interested.
Okay.
So, hello.
You know, the
or something about the performance, whatever comes to mind.
You know,
you would have been in that hello opening number, right?
Of course. Oh, yes. Okay. Of course. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. All
and,
of the.
And you were which characters in the musical?
So, I play Elder Brown at the beginning
at
of the musical.
At the airport or whatever.
So,
right?
So when they're all getting their mission calls,
right?
You know, so me and
you got sent to what mission?
So me and my companion, his name is Scott Barnhart. His name is Elder Thomas later, but I'm blanking on his name at the beginning. But anyway, we're the ones who it fades into Heavenly Father, where will I go on my mission? So we never hear where we got to go on our mission.
Okay.
So we got to make up where we went every night. So if you listen to the soundtrack, you know, here it's, Elder, can't remember his name, Elder Brown and Elder, you know, and then you don't hear where we get our mission call. Okay. So we're the victim of a fade out there. So anyway, but you know, I'm always struck by the way that Hello captures the sort of indomitable optimism of the missionary spirit. I mean, it is true. I remember, you know, as a missionary, you know, I just reveled in getting the door slammed in my face. I'm not kidding. Like, I had this little game I would play when people would start closing the door. I would try to say as many words as I could and as absurd and strange as I could, because the idea of someone slamming the door being like, watermelons in the basement, sewer rat sauce, like, and having them be like, what did they just say? You know, and maybe opening the door again and going, what? And being like, I knew you'd open the door again. Of course, it never worked. Probably too weird, which is a running theme in my life, too weird. You know, that sort of like, I'm going to win you over. I'm going to win you over with all the charm and all of the like optimism. And you are going to see that I'm doing this without coffee. And you are going to be curious about how I'm doing that. I remember like in high school, even before my mission, I sat next to this girl in my English class. And about, halfway through the year, she was like, do you take vitamins? What are you? She's like, I don't get it. She was like, you're so energetic every single day. And it's just funny because I do feel like there's obviously some inherent personality trait going on here, but I feel like Mormonism really encourages that level of like drive and that level of sort of interacting with people in a way where you give them all of your attention and all of your focus in this moment, and you make them feel awesome about themselves, and you are a walking, talking advertisement for Mormonism, because everybody wants to know how in the heck what is it that made you feel this way and believe this way, you know? And of course, you know, when I was leaving the church, I was like, well, I'm just going to lose all of this ability ability to, you know, to talk to people and you know, have this personality where I can win people over and things like that. And strangely, I didn't lose that. So it clearly had nothing to do with, you know, less to do with Mormonism and more to do with just, you know, the way I like to interact with people, you know. But I really liked Hello as an opening number. I think it sets up the show so incredibly well and sets up the, like, Mormon thing in a way that I can't believe they got. I mean, they got it. That number is just right. It sets you right into the world, and it's funny, but it's also really engaging, and it really gets people kind of revved up for what the show is going to be about.
So 2x2 or Something Incredible, there are just two lines that really, really struck me. I think Elder Price says them. He says, "I want to be the Mormon that changes all mankind."
Yeah.
And then he says, I'll do something incredible that blows God's freaking mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about the, I mean, that is how a missionary feels, right?
Exactly.
Go ahead.
I mean, it's like this nugget of truth that I think very few missionaries would admit, but, you know, you have this fantasy that you're going to go out and you are going to baptize thousands. You know, you're going to be, Alma 32 and bring all these people to the waters of baptism and baptize a whole village of people. And they'll clap their hands with joy and excitement because you were that awesome. And God is going to be like, whoa, I made that. I'm awesome too. You know, like. So,
but I really felt that way on my mission. I really did.
Are you kidding? I absolutely, you know, and I, you know, when I got my first baptism, I was like, this is my destiny. I am changing lives. I'm saving souls. I mean, that appetite for, you know, and I was so, oh my gosh. I remember one of my very first missionary interactions was with this guy who had the discussions before I got to the area, and he, we went to his house, and he hid from us, which is something people did in Mexico a lot. Like, there was one time when we knocked on this other lady's door, and her door was open. As often, they'll leave their doors open to get a little cross breeze, because a lot of them don't have air conditioning in their homes. And literally, I could see her table was in view, and she was hiding under her table, and I could see her foot. And we were, like, knocking, and she wasn't coming out. And I was like, Senora, I see your foot. I can see you. You know, just being so menacing and being like, why don't you come talk to us? What's your problem? You know? But anyway, I just, like, that, like, I have the truth, and I will conquer with this truth. And I remember this guy was like, I just can't. He was hiding from us, and then he finally came out. And he was like, I just can't. I can't anymore. The Virgin Mary just means too much to me, and I just can't. And I was like, you can't or you won't? You won't. That's what it is, really. And I mean, it's like my first day in the mission field, and I just chewed this guy out. I mean, like, what a horrible thing to do. And my companion was like, Elder, maybe you want to work on your bedside manner a little bit and just be a little nicer to the investigators. And I was like, why? We have the truth. Rah! You know? Like. So it's that, like, I'm going to blow God's mind, you know? I'm insane. I mean, it was just, anyway, yeah.
So, Hasidiga Eboy. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably one of the most controversial and powerful numbers in the history of Broadway, right?
I think so. I mean, they were very afraid when the show opened that we were going to have security problems and death threats. And so they had this whole security.
How many times is the F word mentioned in that song?
Oh my gosh. I really,
like 45 or?
I really couldn't. I have not counted, but it's absolutely like, I mean, dozens and dozens of times. And, you know, I mean, Mormons.
What's brilliant about that song is they set it in the context of death and disease and AIDS, and you're like, yeah, they're mad at God.
How could you not be?
So you,
right?
The song wasn't offensive to me, even though I,
right,
you know,
well,
usually
you
don't
know,
use that
you've,
word.
You've lost your wife, you've lost your flocks, you've lost your curse to God and die. You know, who says that to Job? Somebody, right? I mean, it's that thing of like, Well, of course you're angry with God. And by the end, you know, they want the audience to be saying the same thing. Like, well, they probably should be mad at God. If God's forsaken anyone, it's these people who have no access to, you know, they live in such an arid place, they can't even plant crop. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's just everything that could be going wrong in their lives is, and they're sick and they can't get any medical, you know, all this stuff. So if they're not mad at God, whoever God is to them, then they probably should be if they have any sense, you know? And so by the end of the number, they want you to go from shock, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're saying this, to, well, they're not wrong, right?
You're saying they're worried about security?
They were really worried about security. They had all these security briefings, and I think that they thought that maybe there would be, you know, death threats, bomb threats, because this number, they were really worried that it was going to be, it was going to be something that really angered people. And you know, that I think they were really concerned also about the Mormon Church responding in a really, really negative way. And I think the church was, you know, I don't know what went into making the decisions about how the church PR machine handled the Book of Mormon, but the church released one statement about the show, and that was, though the Book of Mormon musical may attempt to entertain audiences for an evening, the Book of Mormon, as a volume of Holy Scripture, will change lives forever by bringing souls unto Christ. That is all they said about the show. They weren't mad. There were no protests. There was nothing. It was like we were saying these ridiculous things on a Broadway stage, and no one, there was never a security problem. We literally had like three people in the course of the whole 3.5 years that I did the show walk out during that number. Most people just either knew what it was coming in, but, you know, for the people like yourself who came on that opening weekend, you couldn't have known what the show was. No one knew what it was about. You were one of the first audiences of the show. And so, you know, we were expecting people to be outraged and leave, and people just, for some reason, they walked this tightrope of, like, too offensive, too vulgar, too much, pushing it too far, and saying something very poignant about people who are in distress. And they walked that line, and they hit it right on the money. They pushed people just far enough without pushing them too far. Now you've crossed the line, I'm going to leave, you know. And in an interview, Matt Stone, I think, talks about how, you know, he was like, well, we were hoping more people would, you know, storm out during that number. And he was like, you know, one day I did see a woman throw down her program and walk out. And he was like, well, thank goodness somebody's outraged. You know, everybody else was sitting there. So, I think that number was, you know, a very, very interesting way for them to introduce the conflict of the people.
So did you sing a line and turn it off?
Yes.
What was your line? Sing it for us if you want.
Oh, I sing it's right after the Elder McKinley's, you know, kind of big preamble, and I'm the first missionary. My name is Elder Michaels in that scene, and I just, you know, I just walk up and sing, turn it off like a light switch. You know, I'm just one of the first people to kind of sing, and so you can hear me on the cast album found on iTunes. And so, you know, it was such an awesome experience to get to do a original cast album of something that was so incredibly personal, and you know, and that number is just so crazy accurate about how, you know, the one thing that I think Mormons do slightly is, more a Mormon wouldn't say like, oh, I just turn off my feelings, but you know, the concept of like, I'm having improper thoughts, so instead I'll hum my favorite hymn, you know, or I'm gonna start thinking about something else, something appropriate, you know. I don't think a Mormon would say I'm gonna turn it off, but it's exactly what we do, you know. But instead we would say like, I just think about something righteous instead of something unrighteous, which is basically the same thing. So,
All American Prophet, sort of mocking Joseph Smith a little bit. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's a great way for them to set up how the I think it's a great way for them to set up the way that they're presenting the Mormon story in an irreverent way, but that gets the information across, because you need that setup for any of the stuff in Act Two to sort of make sense, where Elder Cunningham makes up his own version of the events. So, you know, you've got what Elder Price told them about Joseph Smith, and you've got all this stuff, and then you've got Elder Cunningham's version, and then you get in the second act, you get that pageant that they present for the mission president with all the pride. You know, we're presenting this beautiful story, and it's like these two stories woven together. And so, you know, my brother Clay, who sort of encouraged me to go ahead and audition, he actually was there that same weekend that you were there. He saw one of the first previews of the show, and he was really struck by that number, because he was like, people were laughing so hard at the story, and he was like, why is this so funny? Should I be offended that they're laughing at this? And he was like, because I'm not sure if I'm offended or not, you know, which I love that, like, I'm not sure if I'm offended. Should I be offended, you know? So, I mean, I think when you take offense to something, you should probably know that, you know? So, anyway, so I think that, you know, they set up that very well. And, you know, I got to play Brigham Young in that scene, which I thought was particularly apropos. Plus, I think I look fabulous with little curls. You know, sometimes those Brigham Young curls, so I had to do a pirouette at the end of that number, and sometimes the curls would fall out, and I would start the number looking like Brigham Young, and I would end the number looking a little like Doris Day in Glass Bottom Boat. Just a little bit of a flip.
That was okay with you.
Well, I mean, of course, you know. Anyone who can turn from Brigham Young into Doris Day is okay by me.
So Salt Lake City was just a beautiful number.
I love that. It's absolutely one of my favorite songs they wrote. It's one of my favorite moments in the play. I think it really captures the spirit of a convert. I think it captures what it's like to be someone hearing a message. And it's sort of what you said about that that little extra, that truth. This is true. Did you ever wonder who you are? Did you ever wonder what your purpose on earth is? Well, I can tell you. I can tell you who you were before you came to earth. I can tell you where you're going. I can tell you what's going to happen to you. And I can tell you how to get to the best, most beautiful place in the world. I can tell you how to get to paradise. I can teach you if you follow. So, you know, that spirit of like someone who is just so vulnerable to, you know, their life is not good. And you know, the people who I found to be the most receptive to the gospel as a missionary and even beyond my mission were people who were vulnerable and unhappy in their life. They were looking for something. And, you know, those are the people who really, really latch on to the message of Mormonism. They want something to believe in, and they want it to be true. So I love her, the sincerity of her character being like, oh my gosh, paradise does exist. And now it has a name, you know? It has a name, and it's Salta Lake City. You know, it's this beautiful place. I mean, how incredible is that? That's this idea that, you know, Zion and paradise, even this sort of, you know, paradise for Mormons, you know, this place where we were able to practice our religion freely and get away from the, you know, the oppression of the United States, is this, like, you know, place of paradise for her. I just love it. I think it's so brilliant.
And Mormonism really does mean that to so many people.
It absolutely does. Absolutely. It's a lifeline, you know. I even feel like, you know, so much of my mom's faith paradigm and her connection with Mormonism was it's a lifeline to a sort of, you know, a happier life. You know, my mom grew up with an alcoholic father who was sort of supposed to be Mormon, but, you know, was just an alcoholic and not a good father and provide, you know, scared her. And I think for her, Mormonism was a safe place, a safe haven where she could, if she followed the rules, she could be safe and happy. And so I think you're absolutely right. For so many people, it's this paradise. It's like, if I do what I'm told, I can have everything. I can have all that the Father hath, you know?
That's one of the awful paradoxes of trying to talk about the things that are wrong with the church, because you inevitably mess with and sometimes soil people's beautiful image of the church.
I know. And that feels like a violent act, you know, crushing the glass menagerie, you know, taking someone's beautiful something that's so beautiful and sacred to someone and shitting on it, you know, saying it's false, saying it's wrong. And that's it's like taking a bat to, you know, someone's beautiful china that they've kept for generations. And this is my grandmother's beautiful vase, and you're crushing it. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's such a double-edged sword. And I think that is also what's so hard about leaving the church, because you want to be, honest about that. You feel that it's harmful to some people and that you feel that it's been damaging to you. And you want to make it very clear that you needed to get out, and you want to make it clear that you don't believe in it anymore. And you've had it up to here with pretending. And so, you know, you're a bull in a china shop, just crushing everything around you. And you're crushing grandma's beautiful vase that been treasured for centuries, this belief system. It's so precious. And so, you know, on my way out of the church, I've just tried really, really hard to be very, very careful with the china. You know, I don't want to knock anything down. I don't want to break anything that matters to the people that I love. It matters to me that they have the things that are precious to them around them in life. I don't want them to think that I'm violent or destructive. And so I try to leave things standing if I can. And I try to keep things that would break down things for others to myself. And, you know, in Mormonism, what you learn is that a essential tenet of your faith is missionary work, right? You believe in it, but that's not enough. You need to take it to other people, because I've tasted this fruit and it's delicious, and delicious above all that's delicious. And I now my first desire is to share it with my family, right? Well, you leave the church and that doesn't go away, right? You still have to be, you're part of, essential part of your now new faith, which is a lack of, you know, the anti-Mormonism or believing in something else, is you still want to share it with others. You're still a missionary, you know. You've still been trained to believe that an essential aspect of your faith is missionary work. So now you're a missionary for getting people out of the church. And then you get, you know, then you become part of this zeitgeist of like, oh, well, everybody who leaves the church just tries to take everybody with them. And they can't leave the church alone. They're just obsessed with the church after they leave. All they do is talk about the church. They try to get people to come with them. And I'm like, well, you know where they learned that.
So you talk about not wanting to break grandma's beautiful china.
Yes.
And the tenderness you feel towards the beauty and the meaning that the church has towards other people. Mm-hmm. Yet, the Book of Mormon musical could probably be held up in the history of Mormonism as one of the things that people would say does that the most. How have you reconciled that?
Well, so, you know, the way I view the show, and my take on the show, is that if you look at it, and you don't pay attention to what it's actually saying, and you're in a victim stance, and you're in a persecution stance, and many Mormons are in a like everyone's out to get us, everyone makes fun of us, everyone thinks we're weird, you know, if you're looking for that, then you're going to see that in the show, but if you're the kind of Mormon who is like, this is my faith, I believe in it, I believe that it ennobles me, I believe that I'm a better person because I'm a Mormon, if you're that person and you're not thinking that everyone's out to make fun of you because you're Mormon, if the stance that you're in is a stance of love and not a stance of persecution with the world, then I think you see the show as faith-affirming. Because I think you say, oh, look what they're saying about faith. They're saying that faith brought people together. They're saying that faith matters. And they're saying that it doesn't even matter that something's true. They're not even saying that Mormonism's false. They're saying Mormonism's weird, but it is. Mormonism's weird. Catholicism's weird. Islam is weird. Judaism's weird. Everything's weird. All religions are weird. You know, any story you tell is a weird story. So to me, they're not saying, look how weird Mormonism is. Let's all laugh at it. They're saying, yeah, Mormonism's weird. All religions are weird. But look what it did when people believed in it. It made them better. It made them better. So to me, if you're looking for an affirmation of faith, then you see that in the show. I personally do not need a faith paradigm. I don't want a faith paradigm anymore. I don't want to attach myself to any belief system. But I'm also not atheist. I feel firmly agnostic in that I don't know. and I don't need to know, and I find great value in not knowing, because then life can be a mystery to me, and I can experience life with an open heart, and I can look at people's faith paradigm and not go, oh, you are so wrong. You don't even know how wrong you are, you know, which was totally the way I was as a Mormon. I mean, I tried to temper that as much as possible because I still wanted people to like me, but, you know, but that's the way I felt. And now I can walk through the world and be like, you believe in Zoroastrianism? Great. Good for you. Like, I think that's awesome. Tell me about it. You know, I can walk through life and be happy for people's faith and not judge it. So I think for a Mormon who feels like their faith is getting knocked down, I think that they're looking for their faith to be knocked down, to be honest. I do. I think they're looking for antagonism, and I think they're looking for someone to attack them. And maybe that brings value to their religious paradigm. To feel that it's under attack must mean that someone wants it. It's valuable. It needs to be under attack. Someone needs to be trying to plunder it for it to be worthwhile. That's not the way I view faith, and that's not the way I view Mormonism. And the people in my life don't view Mormonism through that lens. And so I think that, you know, I think that people who have faith in their, they'll see it as a good thing. I think they'll see it as faith affirming. I know that that's the way I view it.
Do you think Matt and Trey had that intent?
1,000%.
Well, I mean, because they're viewed as, like, anti-religious.
They're not anti-religion. They really wanted, people to think that they were going to write an anti-religion thing. But even that South Park episode that's dum-dum-dum-dum-dum.
What about the Mormons, it's called.
You know? They, even at the end, you know, they have that little kid be like, okay, you know what? I know my religion's weird. But you know what? I have a great family. I love my family. They love me, you know?
And then they
say, I don't care. I don't care that it's weird.
And then they say, suck my balls.
Yeah, suck my balls. Exactly. You know?
But they do. But you think they're not anti-religious.
That's exactly it's the same message of Book of Mormon. Like, you know what? I know my religion's weird, but you know what? I have a great family. We love each other. That's what matters. You know, and yeah, you can suck my balls, you know, like, so I think that if you can look at Book of Mormon in that way and you look at that episode, that's exactly how they feel about religion. I think they're anti-bullshit. I think they're anti-people getting pushed around, and I think they're anti-using religion to be violent, and I think they're anti-using a religion as a way to control people's minds. Absolutely, they're anti those aspects that have been tied with religion, but they're certainly not anti-faith, and they're certainly not anti-family, and they're certainly not anti-cohesion, togetherness. And religion does provide that for a lot of people. Unfortunately, it also does a lot of those other things that I've just mentioned, and they're certainly anti that.
Any other your favorite parts or meaningful parts of the musical before we talk about your life after the musical?
Oh, okay. So, you know, I think that, you know, that ending that I sort of alluded to, where it turns out that the Africans knew that it wasn't true all along. Because here you are thinking, oh my gosh, those stupid Africans, how can they believe this insane story? Where it comes to light that they actually understood that this whole religion was just a metaphor, but they still believe in it. They still love it. To me, that's just such a brilliant, brilliant moment in the show where you really realize what the show is about. And if you've been too offended by the language, and if you've been too offended by the story of the Book of Mormon at that point to be open to what is happening in real time on stage, you'll miss that. You'll miss what the show is really about because you're stuck being offended and you're stuck being furious that what you hold sacred is being held up and ridiculed. It's not. It's not being held up and being ridiculed. It's being used as a template to describe all religions and that all religions have stories that are unbelievable and hilarious if taken at their sort of most root value. So I just, you know, for me to get to be part of the show and for me to get to be part of, you know, in my Mormon journey, in my journey out of the church, to then be able to be part of something that in my mind comments so lovingly on Mormonism and on faith and is so accurate in capturing the Mormon spirit is just incredibly, incredibly meaningful and incredibly fun and incredibly fulfilling, you know, to get to to get to really be part of something that encapsulates Mormonism in this way and is such a big part of now what Mormon culture is, even for Mormons who are constantly having to talk about Book of Mormon the musical and what they thought of it, and you know, them having to decide how they're going to answer that question when they probably haven't seen it to begin with, I think is, you know, just so cool to get to be part of that.
I actually felt like it was a great honor to Mormonism.
I agree. That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah. Okay, a couple just quick questions about being in a musical, and then we'll how do you get up for doing the same performance 5, 6, 7 times a week for like 3.5 years?
So first of all, it's 8 times a week.
Okay. Yeah, how do you not want to kill yourself like the 1,000th time, and you did it how many?
1,200, yeah. 50, yeah.
The 100th time, the 50th, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, most Broadway actors who are in long-running shows are really sick of it. They're really, but they do as good of a job as they can of pretending that they're, you know, they're in theater, there's something called the illusion of the first time. So you've done it 1,000 times, but you need to look like you're doing it for the first time. That's your job, you know? And so, you know, coffee is a very big part of Broadway. People, you know, and for most people, the longer they're in the show, the more shots of espresso tend to end up in their latte to, you know, kind of continue getting that energy up. But, you know, I think that, you know, especially when you're doing a show like that, it's such a good show, and people love it so much and appreciate it so much that even if you're feeling a little grouchy on, you know, on a Sunday afternoon after a long weekend, and you've done, you know, and you know, Broadway actors only have one day off a week, and so you don't get a lot of time out of the theater. You kind of, when you're in a show, you kind of live it. You're living there, and the theater is your family and your home. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's easier when you have a great show. When you have a crappy show that you're doing, then you just have to be professional and do your damn job and do a good job of putting on a show for people and try to appreciate that you wanted this very badly before you got it, and you have a great opportunity here that most people are sleeping with very, very ugly people to get. They're putting up with a lot of effort and auditions and things like that. And so, you know, I think you try to remember that and just and do a good job and give the audience their money's worth, because people are paying a lot of money to see that show. So,
but it can be enjoyable the 500th time or the
absolutely there. I mean, especially with that cast, because people were so fun, you know. So to get to do that and be on stage, and of course every show is slightly different. You know, any actor will tell you that every show has its own little anomalies, and sometimes really, really you have a great time. I mean, even on my 1,000th, you know, and then around my two and a half year mark, one of my friends from BYU who was in the musical theater program with me, one of my very, very close friends, he had been on the national tour of Book of Mormon for a year, and he joined the Broadway company. And so that was so amazing, because we went to BYU together, and we were together in all of our beginning musical theater classes, and we took dance classes together. And, you know, he's one of my closest friends and associate. His name's Jacob. So he came into the show, and he was there for my whole last year, and he really gave me fresh legs to do the show and enjoy being on stage and experience a lot of gratitude again, because it very quickly becomes difficult to continue to be grateful for it. It's just such a weird thing. You know, you know what they say about an actor? The best way to get an actor to complain is to give them a job. And it really is true. Like, you know, you want a job so desperately, and then you get one, and then nothing's right about the job, and oh, the director, he's such an asshole, and oh my gosh, all this, that, you know, and oh, my shoes, they're so uncomfortable. You never believe how uncomfortable these shoes are. You know, it's just like, it's so funny. It's very hard to remain in a state of gratitude, I think, and I don't know exactly why that is, but that seems to be the state of affairs.
And it's the musicals, is it broken records?
It's broken so many records. It's broken records for that theater. It's broken records on touring houses. It recouped its initial investment at sort of record pace. I mean, it's definitely the most successful Broadway musical in years and years, and will continue to run. And you know, they're they're doing an amazing job managing it and keeping good, great people in the cast. And, you know,
and it won Tonys, like 7 Tonys?
It won 9 Tonys. Yeah. You don't shortchange us.
And you were on the
Tony performance. Yeah, it was where, you know, we were all there watching, you know, as a cast as we won all those Tonys, and it was incredibly memorable moment. And, you know, to do a show that's so personal to my life and then have it be such a creative success as well as a commercial success. I mean, it was a great way to, you know, end my career as a performer.
So let's transition. Tell us what you want to about your life since the musical.
Well, so, you know, I sort of mentioned that I was pre-med during my education. And, you know, about two years into Book of Mormon, my agent started saying, now, do you want to go to some auditions for some other shows? And I was like, I guess it's probably time for me to start looking for my next project. And they kept calling me with auditions for things there's a new Broadway show called Matilda coming in, and, you know, do you want to go to an audition for that? And I just didn't want to go to any auditions for anything. And I was like, well, maybe I just really like this show and I just want to stay here. And then I just realized that I didn't want to perform anymore, and that I had immensely enjoyed my career, but I didn't want to perform anymore.
How do you beat that experience?
Exactly. I was like, what can I possibly do after this that's going to be more interesting, better recognized as a great piece of theater? There's you know, and it's not even like, well, I can't top this, so I'm going to quit. I mean, it was also that, but it was also, I was just not, I didn't want to, I wanted to be an actor for a couple years, maybe, you know, and I thought it'd be a fun idea. But after 12 years, I was like, oh, I'm very much overdue on this, this jelly has expired, and I should probably stop eating it. It's pretty moldy. You know, this dream had sort of expired. And so I sort of got my ducks in a row and used the last year and a half I was in the show to sort of get things in motion to apply for medical schools. And I got into a medical school in New York City, and I just finished my first semester of medical school. So.
So in terms of your life unraveling and you becoming dark and loathsome by leaving the church.
Yes.
Tell us how things have gone for you.
You know, I truly, and I mean this with all sincerity, I truly, when I began to leave the church, I truly accepted the reality that I would be unhappy outside of the church, but that I would probably survive better outside the church. And that because I would survive, that would make it better. But I truly accepted the reality that I would constantly live with a sense of immense loss for having lost my faith paradigm and lost the blessings of the gospel. And I cannot overstate how firmly I believed that that was true. I said, I'm in a terrible position. I'm going to be unhappy no matter what I do, whether I stay or go. But I refuse to die, and I refuse to live my life wanting to die. And so I need to leave. And I know I'll be unhappy leaving, but at least I'll survive. That was truly my mindset when I left the church. I truly believed that if I left the church and stopped attending church, I believed that I would be unhappy and that I would miss it. And I don't mean to be mean, but I truly never once, not the first Sunday to this Sunday, I never once have missed going to church. I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. I didn't miss Sunday school. I didn't miss testimony meeting. I didn't miss the sacrament. I didn't miss anything. It was the weirdest thing. It was like, it was like the Twilight Zone. And then, I met someone wonderful. And
tell us his name.
Matt is my boyfriend. He's here. My family has completely embraced him. My parents invite us to come home. We're staying at my parents' house now. They're putting us in a bedroom together. They're not being like, now you can sleep in the den and Matt can sleep in the, you know, they're like, you're a couple and we love Matt and we see how happy you are and we want you to be happy and we want you to come home because we love you. You know, they're there. That's where it needs to get. Because at some point, parents have to realize that they're not responsible They're not responsible for their choices of their child. And them saying, you can come home, but Matt can't. Or you can come home, but you and Matt can't sleep in the same room. How are you in any way endorsing, not endorsing? You're not changing your child's behavior. You're just being an asshole to your child. You really are. Like, they're having sex. They're having sex. What does it matter if they're not going to come to your house and, like, you know, do it in your sheet. You know what I mean? Like, they're going to sleep together like a normal couple at Christmas. And they're going to show up on Christmas morning and they're going to open their stocking and they're normal. You know, we're a normal couple and we're home for Christmas and we're here to see the new, you know, our new niece, Bridget, and we're saying hi to everybody. And my parents got it. They get it. They get it. They are so loving. They adore Matt. They give him the same love and respect that they give any other spouse in the family. They're happy for us. I am so proud of my parents. They have been so, so amazing. Like, So, as far as people, you know, I speak to the, you know, I just got tempted to address the camera the way that Satan does. I have a word to say concerning these people. Satan, no, don't look at the camera. It's bad form. Don't do it. I guess what I want to say to people who are really in that state of mind, not everyone is the same. I get that. And I'm not going to make the mistake of saying one size fits all, because I believed that as a Mormon, and that has not proven to be true. I do not believe that there's one way to believe or one way to live that works for everyone. And I don't believe that I have a gospel, a new gospel, that I'm going to try to share with people. I don't believe that there's one right way to do things, and I certainly don't believe that I have the answers to people's questions about how to live. I'm not a missionary for any gospel. My own opinions are mine, and they have things that I have earned over the years, and my experiences have taught me certain things, and people might take some of the things that I have learned and connect with them, and that's wonderful. But in no way do I say, this is the answer, and you should listen to me, because I saw what that was like when I was a Mormon, and I didn't like the way it made me feel to have all the answers and to insist that other people take those answers as truth. So that's a huge disclaimer. But I will say to people considering leaving the church, or to people who are on the outskirts or on the fringes, who feel like they're not going to be happy outside of the church because that's what they've been told, or they're going to feel very guilty having sex outside of marriage, or they're going to feel very guilty having gay sex with someone that they love. I will say that for myself, that has been so incredibly false. I am so much happier than I was when I was in the church. That may not be true for everybody. I don't think everyone needs to leave the church. I don't think every gay person needs to leave the church. If you're doing good there and you're cooking, good, great. Be at church and let other Mormons see that a gay person's a good person. Good for you. I think that's fantastic. For me, it was a violent place. For many gay people, it's a violent place. I think if you're thinking about your own death, gay or not, I think you need to get out. I do. I think you need to get out and go to safety, because when your place of protection is being bombarded, you should get out of that place, because that's, you could die if you get bombed. Go to safety. And safety may be out of the church. And I think I want to testify that you can be happy outside of the church. I am. And many Mormons watching this will say, you think you're happy, but you're not. And all I can say to that is, you don't know. You don't know whether I'm happy or not. I could be lying. I could be promoting an agenda. I could be trying to get people out of the church. I'm not. But, you know, if people aren't convinced of that by hearing what I've had to say, that's okay with me too. But I have no agenda. I have no motive. My motive is to save people who are in danger and who have become a danger to themselves. And I want you to save yourself if you are in danger. I think that you owe it to yourself to live. I think that you should get out of the church rather than get out of life. I think that you may have something wonderful to accomplish, and I think you should stick around to try to figure out what that is, even though you don't see what it is from now. And, you can accomplish a lot. You can accomplish a lot, and you can take your experiences, and you can help others, and you can help yourself. But, you know, for me, getting out of the church was one of the best decisions of my life. You know, finding someone to love is one of the best decisions of my life. Allowing myself to be loved by someone and sharing a full life sexually, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually has been it's the pinnacle of my existence. It's my biggest passion. My relationship with Matt is so incredibly important to me. I'm so happy that I get to share that with my family now. I'm so glad that my family understands that my relationship stems from love and doesn't stem from some sort of broken, sexual, dysfunctional deviance. I'm so glad that they see it for what it is, and that's human love and compassion. And I'm incredibly happy to be on a journey now that a new journey with my career, and I'm happy that the church and leaving the church has given me the strength and tenacity to challenge old paradigms and have the guts and heart to try something new and something that's difficult and look at a long road ahead of me in medicine and say, I'm not afraid to put in some hard work to get somewhere that's worthwhile. I've survived worse than this, and I will continue to accomplish things, and I want my dreams in life to come true, and I have the power to go after that.
Well, to be honest, Clark, you've summed it up better than I could have tried to shape you to sum it up.
That's not true, but thank you for saying that.
No, I just want to thank you for coming on Mormon Stories, for sharing your story with us. I think you're going to save lives through this interview and
through your
shining example. I remember Carolyn Pearson once saying that the best thing a young gay kid can do is to let their light so shine to the earth, and that's the best testimony they can give. And I think you're doing that, so congratulations.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for coming on Mormon Stories.